I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Hi, folks. Yes, this is your old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We specialize in struggle from below. And there's so much to discuss nowadays, a great uptick in those struggles in a world that is rapidly changing and must change. Indeed, to survive, we're going to have to wholly reconstruct the ways we produce and consume and live together. And maybe in a space of 15 to 30 years. Well, can we meet this challenge? Sure. We've developed all the technologies, the living models of sustainable production, of stable, egalitarian, and radically democratic societies. What we lack are movements strong enough to replace our current predatory elites, who are busily exploiting their fellow humans and the ecosystems on which life depends, that to maintain power and make profits. Today on the Old Mole, like every Monday morning at 9, we report on those movements from below that will someday, if we survive, be seen by historians as the forces whose struggles created that other necessary, better, democratic, and sustainable world. Today we examine climate justice with Tom Athanasio of the organization EcoEquity. We also hear from Jovanna Beckles about how the Richmond Progressive Alliance won political power in that California city. Mole Clayton Morgeridge reflects on U.S. history and prospects for a new revolution. Mole Larry Bolden will review the novel Do Not Become Alarmed by Mail Meloy. And our musical breaks today will feature five of the best-known popular songs that reflect young people's great concerns that their predecessors have left them with a planet whose ecosystems on which life depends, all life, in fact, may be fatally compromised. Tom Athanasio, welcome to KBOO.
Good to be here. How are you doing today?
Good. Tom Athanasio founded and directs EcoEquity, whose principal goal is justice for the poor within an emergency global climate mobilization, which he hopes to live to see. He speaks and writes a lot, including the book Divided Power, The Ecology of Rich and Poor, and he's now writing a third book on justice and transformation in the greenhouse century. Tom Athanasio, I talked to you a couple of weeks ago about Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Accords. Since 1999, you've been agitating and evaluating and writing at the many international meetings on how to stop climate change catastrophe. You've concluded that the Trump pullout was, in fact, all things considered, good, in that had this country stayed, it would have done what so many business interests in the U.S., particularly big oil and coal, wanted to do, which is not to slow down the international effort, but also get the world body to approve their proposals, that is, clean coal, clean oil, carbon sequestrations, approve them as legitimate methods of reducing emissions. And that, of course, would then lead to the countries getting the green light and approval to spend a lot of money for research and model building and give it to those same companies. Anyway, in the wake of the Trump pullout, the Chinese and Europeans, in fact, a number of countries affirmed their support for the Paris Accords, that they would stay in and committed to take meaningful steps. So, Tom, what are the chances they will take meaningful steps, and particularly take meaningful steps to assist the exploited poor and most vulnerable countries of the global south?
First of all, I want to say that the U.S. will still be attending the meetings, and so there's still going to be lots of opportunities for the Trump administration to gum up the works. So that's something that's going to be an ongoing trench battle that is going to continue to unfold. What are the possibilities that the countries of the world will actually pivot to a more explicitly fair transition architecture? And are those chances better with the U.S. being out? That is an excellent, excellent question. And I have to say that I'm sorry this is radio, but the answer isn't simple. I mean, the fact that the U.S., which is by far the wealthiest country in the world, will not be participating in any support regime for the developing countries and the most vulnerable countries and the countries that want to leapfrog to a 100% renewable economy, the fact that the U.S. won't be doing its share to assist that transition is certainly not going to make it easier for other countries to step up. At the same time, it's very, very clear that the catastrophe of the Trump administration has motivated a lot of countries, including the Chinese and the Europeans in particular, to take a more forceful leadership roles. So we don't really know what's going to happen. What we do know is that the world is mobilized, and hopefully that will make a big difference. You got to remember that what happens at the international level is only a reflection of what happens at the nation-state level and what happens at the local level. That said, it's extremely important, but still it's only a reflection.
You know, before we talk about what specifically should be done and the sequence of things that should be done and the technologies that show the most promise for fairly rapidly moving towards the climate greenhouse gas emission numbers and concentrations that would at least greatly reduce climate change and global warming. The Chinese are taking credit now for sort of leading the revolution towards renewable energy, and they surely have through investing tremendous sums of money in the production processes for solar and to some extent wind turbines. They've really lowered the costs and they're almost cornering the market. They're so cheap. The Germans can barely compete and the U.S. manufacturers have trouble competing as well. What do you make of the Chinese? Are they going to move? They're now the greatest polluters on Earth, though, in addition to, of course, the greatest producers of solar panels. What about the Chinese and Europeans? Do they show signs of actually doing things versus paper and word commitments?
Yeah, this is always the big question is who's moving the fastest? Are they moving fast enough? Who's moving the slowest? Why? What would it take to get them moving faster? And it's always the big question, and it's a complicated question, but I think the simple answer is that the Chinese are doing a tremendous amount, and they're having transition problems. Like, for example, they have got more wind online than they have grid to move the wind electricity around. They promised to get on top of that. And they're shutting down their dirtiest coal plants, but on the other hand, they're investing in clean coal. They're building out a huge amount of solar, but they're also building a huge amount of nuclear, so which we might or might not agree with. So it's a complicated situation, but the short answer is that the Chinese are taking climate very, very seriously. And I also just have to say that, yes, it is true that China is the largest polluter on the planet, but it is not the largest polluter on a per capita basis. And so that's always very important to be clear about this. We still do a lot more damage per person.
Yeah, and in fact, it could fairly easily be avoided just through a number of different conservation measures. Those are the lowest hanging fruit, and they could really make a difference.
I'd like to say one thing else about China, which is really interesting, which is that the central government in China is the political actor that's supporting the transition and driving the transition. It's really the opposite of what's going on in the United States, where local people and state governments are driving the transition and the national government is doing everything in its power to stop the solar transition and to continue the reign of fossil fuel capital. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting political situation. What's happening is that people are asking now in China, is the central government strong enough to pull this off, given the fact that there's so much resistance from, say, provincial power structures and provincial elites, many of which are really, really rooted in coal. So it's a hugely interesting situation when you compare the U.S. and China and the political challenges of making the transition that we need to make.
Tom, let's switch gears and talk about climate justice. Earlier we spoke and you pointed out there has to be a sequencing. Tell us about that. What would be required for climate justice and gaining that support all over the world? If it's not seen as fair, it's not going to happen, as you pointed out. Tell us your story.
You know, in the United States, when we hear the terms climate justice, we think about fence-line communities, and we think about the poor being choked by fumes. And there's a rapidly expanding climate justice agenda, but basically we think about it in those kinds of terms. When you're thinking about climate justice from the global perspective, the picture and the challenges look really different, and you have to spotlight the fact that some parts of the world are much, much richer and have much more historical capacity, has much more historical responsibility, and much more financial and technological capacity to meet the challenges of the transition. So it's a different set of climate justice problems. But it's interesting that it, both the local level and the global level, it's true that if the transition is not fair and not embraced by people for their own self-interest to better their own lives, it's not going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen fast enough. We're talking, after all, about a transition that's historically unprecedented. We have to eliminate carbon-based fuels in a very, very short period of time, shorter than one human lifetime, which, as you know, is very short. And we've never done anything like this. And to imagine that we're going to be able to pull it off in a world where the richest 1% of the human population owns, as it now does, more than everyone else, is just foolishness. It's simply not going to happen. The bottom line is that climate is a global problem. It's a global commons problem. And it can only be solved if each actor, in this case nation states, sees the other actors to be doing their best to do their fair share. So justice is a first tier issue at the level of fair shares, who's pulling their own weight. That same issue, not coincidentally, is at the absolute forefront of class politics and economic justice politics at the level of local communities. We have to find ways forward that yield very, very rapid technological and infrastructural change while at the same time lifting up the poor and protecting the vulnerable. And that challenge takes different forms in different countries, and it takes different forms at the local level and at the global level, but it's the same challenge.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Tom Athanasio. We're talking about climate justice and the way in which the vast changes in the way we produce energy and use energy, and in fact, the way we live, have to be made. Tom, you pointed out the considerable differences in how states are going to have to change. It seems to me, though, there are some common themes, which I think you agree with, that localities, especially, of course, in the poor world, as you pointed out, want to leap way ahead in going to 100% renewable energy fairly quickly. The quickest and easiest ways to produce clean energy is not to have to build huge grids everywhere, highly secure, extremely expensive, environment-destroying themselves, and vulnerable to attack, but in fact, local energy of many kinds. The sun is shining all over the world. The wind blows. We have the capacity now and the technology right now, it seems to me, to change production and especially energy production very radically and very quickly. Worker skills are certainly sufficient. In the United States, we have an abundance of those skills that would be necessary for both small-scale utility, but for producing local energy. Some big facilities, of course, on the outskirts and sometimes in the cities, but many, many smaller facilities, all of them connected in local grids. Tell us about that. And in the poor world, in fact, in the big cities, that would also be true, and every village could be electrified fairly easily with not too much money. Anyway, that's my hypothesis. Tell us about it.
That's absolutely true. To a first order, what we're talking about is a very rapid transition to a net zero carbon global economy. For many of us, that means a 100% renewables economy. And renewables are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're spread around the planet. And in a 100% renewables economy, there's much less need to ship photons, electrons, large distances, right? We just don't need the same kind of grid. So local energy production, whether wind or geothermal or tidal or direct solar photovoltaic, should be maximized. And we need a grid which is extremely resilient and extremely decentralized. That said, there are challenges which the local energy people don't always take seriously. One of them is the load management issues that come up at the level of nations and continents. But that is a challenge that we can solve. Another one is the fact that we are becoming a highly urban society. By 2050, 70% of the human population is going to be living in cities, and we want this to take place so that we can rewild the countryside and give some space to the animals, right? And that means that we have to be able to provide concentrated 24/7, 365 energy to huge cities. And that means we have to deal with some very, very heavy metal issues. So it's a complicated issue. I mean, if you really drill down on this bill and you're technically minded, there's very little that's more interesting than the debates that are going on about grid architectures going forward, because they have to do with city rural issues and democracy issues and local control over regional control. It's fantastic. It's the kind of problem we want to have, right? And that's the main thing to remember. This is a solvable problem. It's the kind of problem we want to have.
Yeah, the storage problem is a major one, of course, but that can be solved. I mean, we're on our way. For certain.
Absolutely.
It's just
Absolutely.
It's a matter of money, basically, and not of whether our technologies have to be that improved.
We basically have the technologies. We need to scale them up and deploy them globally,
right.
But we basically have them.
Yes, and do it in a just manner, which is not that expensive, actually, when you look at the world production capacity and the amount of wealth as measured by being able to produce things. It's enormous. We have so many shuttered factories. We have the resources. It can be done in an environmentally sustainable manner. It seems to me it's all possible. In the George Bush, the first phrase, to change it a little bit, we really have the wallet. What we don't have is the political will.
Yes, we certainly have the money. We're talking about large, large sums of money when we're talking about saving human civilization. But I always like to use the following thought experiment. Say it costs $1 trillion a year to save human civilization for 50 years. So say the bottom line bill was $50 trillion. Would it be worth it?
That's a good question. I want my bank account to stay high, says our elites, regardless.
Bill, it's a distributional issue. We have the money. We have the technology, mostly. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's going to be winners and losers. And so it's the same situation with the climate transition as it is with the fate of democracy. If we don't deal with the fact that the rich have all the money and the rich have all the power, we're not going to make the transition. It really is as simple as that. And the good news is that people know it. The good news is that people really, really know it, and that the catastrophe of the Trump victory, the perfect storm that led to Mr. Trump becoming the nominal president of the United States, has really focused people's minds.
I think in our last interview, you and we conclude this way, Donald Trump could well be our best organizer. So keep at it, Donald, although he has his hand on the trigger as well. And he could.
Yeah, he has his hand, his other little hand.
Yes, he could all, and he has so many little hands on so many things. And he could do enormous harm, particularly to poor people here and around the globe. But that's another matter. We'll talk again. Thanks a lot, Tom Athanasio. Thanks for talking to us. Why don't we pitch your books, Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. What's your second book?
Dead Heat, Global Justice and Global Warming. But they're both pretty old, and I'm working on a new one.
And Tom does not want to give up his title. He's afraid someone else would steal it. But the subtitle will be Justice and Transformation in the Greenhouse Century.
Something like that. Yes,
something
that's
like
right.
That. Tom Athanasio, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Bill.
Right. So long.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I'll blow back out again.
Yeah, there's a long history of environmental songs. You just heard me, Bill Resnick, interviewing Tom Athanasio of the organization EcoEquity. The Mole has also played excerpts from two environmental songs, Michael Jackson's Earth Song and Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Blues. This is your old Mole Variety Hour every Monday at 9 a.m. Stay tuned on today's Mole for reflections on U.S. history and prospects for a new revolution, a review of the novel Do Not Become Alarmed. Next on the Mole, how the Richmond Progressive Alliance won political power in that California city. This is a recording by Mole Denise Morris of Jovanka Beckles, her talk at the Labor Notes Troublemakers School this spring in Portland.
Union members, as you know, we have to be concerned with everything that goes on in our city and in our cities, as well as in our state. And Richmond Progressive Alliance in Richmond, California, is a really, really interesting and innovative organization that Jovanka has been part of and helped to build. Richmond Progressive Alliance, unlike most political parties or political organizations, isn't just involved in electoral work. They're not just involved with candidates. They are involved with deep, deep grassroots organizing. And that's an unusual organization, and it's something that we think we can all learn from. How a union can participate in both deep organizing and getting people elected who are accountable to us and who come out of our movements. That's what Richmond Progressive Alliance has done. Jovanka also has two jobs. She's a mental health specialist with kids, full-time, and she's full-time on the Richmond City Council, so she's a very busy woman, and she's been a longtime union member. She comes from an immigrant family. She understands a lot about what it is to be displaced, to be marginalized, and to be organized. So let's welcome Jovanka Beckles.
Well, thank you very much, troublemakers. How many troublemakers we got in this room? So thank you so very much for having me, for the invitation. It truly is a blessing, truly is an honor to be able to spend the weekend with you guys. Labor Notes has been an important pillar in the movement to build power for working people. And today, we continue that work. Here we have an opportunity to tell the compelling stories that represent our communities, build relationships, and organize like our country depends on it. Because how many of us know it depends, our country depends on it, right? We are having some serious issues with the current administration, and we have to stay organized like unlike any other time in history. So I want to first of all thank the work of Labor Notes activists like Mike Parker and Steve Early on the Labor Knows National Policy Committee. They're my neighbors in Richmond, California, where I currently live. And in addition to being responsible for many local victories for working families, they've made sure our stories are told. I'm a rank and file union member. Every time I think about that, I get a smile on my face. Because I'm reminded of both the vital work I'm called to do for my community and the sacred institution of solidarity that has and will continue to defend it. I work for Contra Costa County. I'm a member of Teamsters Local 856. My job is working with children who have emotional, behavioral challenges. But we've come to understand that, you know, when children are ill in any way that it is, whether it's emotional, behavioral, physical, we know that we can't just heal that child because it's a child. They have to go back home. And in some cases, they're going back home to some really dysfunctional households. And so if you're going to heal the child, you got to heal the household too. So that's what I do. I work with the children. I work with their families. And every day I get up from bed to face the ways racism and poverty create and magnify trauma. If we really want to raise our kids to lead healthy, productive lives with equal opportunity for all, we must make fundamental changes in the way our society works. That's why in 2008, I chose to run for the Richmond City Council. I understood the need to lead in government, to, as I like to call it, occupy elected office. But we have to do that in order to make fundamental change happen. I ran and lost that year, but I came back 2 years later and won, defeating, as I said, multi-million dollar slates of Chevron-backed politicians because our community chose to embark on the political revolution before it even had that name. So we did some things in Richmond, you can do some things here. Now, 14 years ago, neighbors came together to form the Richmond Progressive Alliance. It formed with a simple purpose: bring together the grassroots energy and resources necessary to run pro-working family ballot initiatives and corporate free candidates for local office. By working together towards that simple goal, this is what we did in Richmond as we elected corporate free candidates. We banned the box on job applications for city contractors and public housing. Okay, so how many of y'all don't know what I'm referring to when I say ban the box? Anybody don't know that? You know? Okay.
Yeah.
So ban the box is that little question on applications that says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Now, we all know as soon as you check that box, you can just take it and that's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to do this and throw it in the trash. And so we banned that box to give people an opportunity to have healthy lives and to provide for their families. But we also stopped the police checkpoints that harassed our undocumented neighbors. And we also instituted what we call the Municipal ID Program. Now, what that would do is that regardless of your immigration status, you could get an ID that would allow you to bank, would allow you to fill out applications, etc. So the good thing is in California, legislatures did pass law that says even if you're undocumented, you can now get a driver's license. But that's okay because Richmond, we like to take the lead on things and we didn't wait for them. We did it first and we wanted to protect our residents. So don't wait for somebody else to do what you need to do. Make it happen, brothers and sisters. Make it happen. We also capped emissions at our Chevron Richmond refinery, the single largest point of GHG emissions in California. We're on pace also. This is what we did, electing non-corporate candidates. We also are on pace to have a $15 minimum wage in 2 years. And last fall,
we became the first new rent control city in a generation. But you can do it, and we're here to help organize. So reclaiming the democratic process, you can imagine, was not easy, but it is straightforward. My community organized a coalition of concerned individuals, activist organizations, unions, and community members willing to come into their power. Richmond organized year-round, always keeping the people trying to win policies and elections working together. We knocked on doors and we published a progressive newspaper because in Richmond, Chevron, with their big money, they created something called the Richmond Standard. And so they have hard copies and then they send it out on emails and then there are so many other newspapers that was not really sharing progressive news, like what they were doing to harm us as a community. So we created our own progressive newspaper. It's called the Richmond Sun. So we fought for issues critical to the community, and we challenged the corporate-backed incumbents who refused to change. Labor was there with us. The Richmond Progressive Alliance would not have succeeded without the active support of a number of unions, including SEIU 1021, the California Nurses Association, National Union of Health Workers, NUHW, Amalgamated Transit Union of the 1555, which represents BART in California, Unite Here 2850, primarily hotel and food workers, all right? ASME 3299, which is the largest statewide University of California union, representing occupations like janitors, medical technicians, food service workers, groundskeepers. We also had public PEU, Local 1. We also had UPTECWA 919. And then I see a whole bunch of y'all in here. We also had ILWU. I know there's a bunch of you. I saw you in here. Right on. Shout out to all of you that are here. And so now, of course, by support from the local, by the labor movement, I do not just mean formal endorsements or even money. Those are important, of course, but it's not enough. We need a revitalized labor movement which has the confidence of its membership because the members are the union.
Hear, hear.
Right? Members can understand the issues, be champions for change among their neighbors and families, and help everyone connect the dots. I want to point out that all of these unions that support us regard themselves as progressive unions who defend immigrants and who consciously are looking to build community alliances. SEIU 1021, a huge local representative, a local representing Northern California, has been very important in our battle. But this wouldn't have occurred without the reform slate of leaders who swept the local elections in 2010 with the commitment to building active community alliances and involving its membership. Our struggles are closely connected. We can't think that we have to make a choice between local politics and building the labor movement. It's not a choice. We absolutely have to do both. We've always been organizing, and now people are a lot more ready to stand up. Your coworkers are starting to see what's coming and to be more open to really join in the struggle. Our communities are seeing the threat and responding with solidarity and a love we have not seen in such numbers and strength in a very, very long time. People are now more willing to sacrifice and to overcome their differences to meet this very real threat. I have to say, our neighbors don't step forward to make sacrifices, though, just because of an intellectual debate. The activist's passionate presence is and will remain to be the magnetic core that leads our communities with hopeful and joyful struggle. I'm not worried about winning the factual debate. No, that's not the problem. What we need are more people who wake up every single morning and they listen to music until, or they jog until, or they meditate until they feel the fire for the future. When Richmond was facing bankruptcy, rampant corruption at City Hall, when the police felt like an occupying force, people lacked hope. They felt hopeless. Hopelessness is now thought of as a rational, realistic response to life.
No.
In my mind, that couldn't be further from the truth. But I'm saying that's what people have come to believe in. And somebody back there said, no, you're right, because that's far from the truth. In my mind, the truth is that banding together and knocking on doors will win back our democracy. That vision is very clear. It gives me and my neighbors hope. And with that passion, we have led each other to a totally new grassroots political reality in Richmond.
Bo Diddley's song, Pollution. Stay tuned for a review of the novel, Do Not Become Alarmed. Oh, maybe you should, but not paralyzed. Next on The Old Mole, Clayton Margaridge reflects on U.S. history and prospects for a new revolution.
The guiding star of political action, from the Old Mole's point of view, is the democratic control and ownership of the wealth and resources required to produce our lives. That is, everything that falls under the heading of capital. Pretty much all of this capital is now, directly or indirectly, under the control of the wealthiest tenth of the top 1% of the population, or in the U.S., about 320,000 people. It is their interest in maintaining and expanding their power that dictates what the rest of us have to do, how we have to work in order to live. Genuinely radical political action always aims at chipping away at and eventually abolishing the power of the capitalist class and the basis of that power, the private ownership of capital. The goal is a world in which we all together decide how we shall live. This is what revolution is, fundamental change in the relations of property, and therefore of the conditions of labor. Now, to appreciate what it takes to make such a revolution, it is worth looking back at what has been called the Second American Revolution, the Civil War, and the abolition of slavery. With the end of the war and the passage of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the right to own human beings as property was abolished. The result was that what had been property, almost 4 million enslaved people, valued at over $3 billion, or 18% of the total of all U.S. wealth, suddenly ceased to be property, and all that wealth vanished from the economy. This was a revolution more radical than the first one of 1776 because it worked a fundamental change in property relations. Let's look back at the debate over slavery and the principle of private property in the decades leading up to the Civil War. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution declares that no one can be deprived of their property without due process of law. Now, did that mean that the nation could not deprive enslavers of their property in human beings? Did it mean government could not prohibit moving slaves into new territories? The main issue in the 1830s and 40s was whether the government had the right to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories by admitting new states to the Union as free states. Those who profited from slavery, not only those who owned and drove enslaved people in the South, but the many northern investors in slaves and cotton, knew that slavery could only thrive if it kept expanding to keep up with the world market in cotton. Abolitionists and others who opposed slavery also understood this and hoped to end it by confining it to where it already existed and by repealing the laws that required northern officials to return escaped slaves to their enslavers. In 1836, abolitionists were calling for Congress to use its power over federal territory to end the slave trade and even to ban slavery itself in the District of Columbia. Here is how the South responded, as described by historian Edward Baptist in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun responded to these anti-slavery demands with a speech that outlined a foundational idea. He told the Senate that the Fifth Amendment limited federal power over individuals' property by decreeing that no one could be deprived of his property without due process of law. Calhoun now proceeded to build a sweeping principle on the back of this sentence. Due process, he insisted, could mean only trial by jury of a specific criminal. What the abolitionists proposed was the opposite of due process. Legislative fiat that erased the property claims of a whole class of people. And, said Calhoun, were not the slaves of this district property, and were not their enslavers a whole class of property owners? Presumably, Congress could not prevent people from buying or selling said property, since salability is usually one of property's characteristics. Baptist goes on, Calhoun was stating an idea that would eventually be known as the doctrine of substantive due process. The due process requirements to which the Constitution referred could not be fulfilled simply by passing a law, for a law that invaded the rights of property owners ran up against something too fundamental for procedure to alter. In Calhoun's vision, the Fifth Amendment was a geological outcropping that confirmed that beneath the Constitution lay an underlying substantive tectonic plate of natural law that allowed owners to hold and use property. Now, in 1847, Calhoun went on to argue that the Fifth Amendment denied Congress any right to require that new states outlaw slavery, complaining, quote, resolved, that the enactment of any law which should directly or by its effects deprive the citizens of any of the states of this Union from emigrating with their property into any of the territories of the United States would unjustly discriminate between citizens of slave states and citizens of free states, and would therefore be a violation of the Constitution. He implied that the federal government should actually pass laws to enact the institution of slavery on federal territory, for to do otherwise would be to deprive individual slave owners and indeed all Southern whites, who were, after all, potential property owners, of their rights to emigrate with their property. End of quote. Well, it took a civil war and a constitutional amendment to remove human beings from the category of private property and free them from the direct ownership of capital. But capital still owns and controls the wealth enslaved people created, and it continues to expropriate that so-called free labor today and to dictate the conditions of labor and life. To protect the rights of capital, the principle of substantive due process, protecting private property that was laid down by Calhoun, is very much with us today. As Edward Baptiste writes, after the Civil War, pro-big business legal thinkers from the North would, ironically enough, take up a version of Calhoun's idea. From the 1890s through the New Deal era, the Supreme Court repeatedly used substantive due process to strike down legislative attempts to regulate Gilded Age industry, protect workers' rights, or break up monopolies. Substantive due process shaped and continues to shape the political economy of the United States in enduring ways. End of quote. A good case can be made that reparations should be paid to the descendants of slaves for the wealth that was beaten and sweated out of them. But the wealth owned and controlled by the very wealthiest families rules our world to the extent that a recent study of political power concluded that the U.S. is a plutocracy. Expropriating that wealth and putting it in public hands, that is the next revolution. Abolishing the private ownership of human beings was not easy. Neither will be the abolition of private property in the wealth our labor creates. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar.
Well, you recognize that one, I'm sure. Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi. Before that, Clayton Morgridge reflected on prospects for a new revolution. That is to begin using the wonderful productive capacity and intelligence that we've all created in ways that save the planet from the predators. Next on the Old Mole, Mole Larry Bolden. He'll review the novel Do Not Become Alarmed by Miley Malloy.
One can't have it both ways, and both ways is the only way I want it. So begins the first collection of stories I picked up by this very contemporary writer, Miley Malloy. Both ways is the only way I want it. Literally stunned by her writing, I reviewed the book years ago and then quickly read up everything she had written, two collections of short stories and a kind of novel, only kind of because it was short fiction in a connected, concatenated form, and I think autobiographical. Coincidentally, I also began reading the nature nonfiction of her aunt, Ellen Malloy, especially her wonderful book Eating Stone, who impressed me even more than her niece. A wonderfully creative family, Miley's younger brother is the frontman for the Northwest rock band The Decemberists. Today's comments are directed toward Miley's newest book, Do Not Become Alarmed, which is an alarming title just on its face. And it is in many ways an alarming, gripping, and suspenseful tale. I want to say straight out that I think she should stick to short fiction, where her sparse and stark prose makes for riveting short stories, bare to the bone and so much we hear now stories, we ordinary people in urban settings, we ordinary people in rural settings. Unlike the utterly believable settings for her short stories, this novel I felt was simply too contrived and used a bit too obviously as a vehicle for delivering messages. Messages, incidentally, most of which I believe and agree with, about U.S. arrogance, about racism towards all people of color. But there is a heavy-handedness to the novel that keeps me constantly in mind of Malloy at the helm of the cruise ship on which her characters embark. The characters play their parts in putting a spotlight on the power of money and the privileges of sex and color, but I feel too often the immediate presence of the author backstage instead of letting the story itself drive the message. Since this is, after all, a mystery, I will not give away too much of the story. Suffice it to say that two American couples with their four children embark on a short luxury cruise down the coastline of Central and South America. It is a Christmas present and an escape from Christmas. While the early part of the novel displays primarily the extravagant waste of the cruise ships and the intense economic disparity between the passengers and the crew, the mystery element occurs well into the novel when the families decide to go ashore one day for an outing along with a South American couple that they met on board and their teenage son and daughter. While the men decide on a golfing experience, the women and children embark on a zipline adventure. due to a not particularly believable set of events, a blown tire, a traffic accident, and a long wait for assistance, the women and children end up on what their guide says is a protected lagoon of river meeting sea to escape the heat of the day in relatively calm waters. A few moments of neglect by the adults and the incoming tide washes the children upstream and out of sight. And then the long, only sometimes believable series of events leads to the children being held by a drug lord, who the children have witnessed disposing of a body. This followed by miraculous escapes, train journeys, and a so predictable salvation for most of the children and the guilt-riven adults. Marriages are threatened along with the lives of the children. In many ways, I enjoyed this book. It certainly is a page-turner. My problem is that I have come to expect so much of Malloy. The spare and quick-to-the-point short stories deserve all the accolades they've received. In comparison, this novel seems somewhat inflated and long-winded. It is certainly worth a summer read, but those who have read her other works may find it disappointing. I've been talking about Molly Malloy's Do Not Become Alarmed. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be.
Yes, mercy, mercy me. Also, struggle, struggle, struggle us. I want to give thanks to the people who deserve thanks for this show. Thanks to Larry Bolden, who just heard, for his review of the book, Do Not Become Alarmed. And also to the author, Miley Malloy. To Tom Athanasio for reminding us that equal equity will be required if we are to survive. And we can do it, and we surely have the capacity to replace our predatory and murderous elites. God help them. To Jovanka Beckles for discussing how a People's Alliance took over Richmond, California politics. What's the answer? Well, you get organized. To Clayton on the next revolution that would undermine the enormous power of the private property owners and begin using these vast productive capacities that we've developed that are, in fact, now destroying the earth, in fact, use them to heal the earth. Thanks also to the many giants of popular music, Marvin Gaye, Joni Mitchell, Bo Diddley, Woody Guthrie, Michael Jackson. We played excerpts from all of those very familiar songs today. And, of course, hundreds of others. Thanks for voicing the aspirations, the concerns and aspirations of the people who idolize them. We wonder how the younger generation, how do they show so much environmental sensibility and knowledge, especially when the schools, so afraid of right-wing parents and groups, are, with, of course, some exceptions, there are some wonderful schools, actually, and curriculums. Some of those curriculums developed in Portland, Oregon, by the Rethinking Schools people, but mostly the schools are very cautious in presenting the depth and extent of the threat to human life, indeed most planetary life, that our current system is now creating. Of course, popular culture is really another matter. Our children, all of us, do get messages, and from people they trust. So media is stacked against us, to be sure, but popular culture, well, that's a somewhat other matter. Our singers have their own minds and concerns, and they get through. Thank you to them. In fact, soon we're going to do a report from Eugene, Oregon, from our Children's Trust and the people who are working on the kids' lawsuit against Donald Trump and the United States that has survived. They brought a suit in federal courts. It survived motions to dismiss. There could well be a trial about the U.S. negligence in creating a planet that will so harm our children and their children. It's extremely interesting. We'll be doing that later in the summer. Thanks also to Patricia Kahlberg, our wonderful novelist and KABU voluntary engineer. She's a tough boss, but compassionate some of the time. Patricia will be speaking and reading at Powell's Bookstore downtown from her book, On the Ragged Edge of Medicine. Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. That's Monday, a week from today, June 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Powell's. And thanks to all of you out there who support this station. And since we live stream and archive everything, all 24 hours a day of programming, we get support from all over the planet. Finally, you can hear this show or any part of it again or any of the previous shows or recommend us to your friends. Tell them to go to the web, to KABU, and go to the top right, the search box, and type Old Mole or Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up very soon, by tomorrow, maybe even this afternoon. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off for the Old Mole. See you next Monday at 9. And one final thing, if you haven't done it yet, please call. Call KABU. Go on the web and contribute to that radio station that's the breath of life here in Portland. That's all for today.